then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've your orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more door for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. Put your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 25th, 2016. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, the first thing I want to do this week is to apologize to Gretchen for repeating one of her shows last week that I'd already podcast a couple of weeks before. I just wasn't paying sufficient attention, and I didn't realize that I'd already used that clip. I normally catch things like that when I replay the entire recorded and edited episode on my MP3 player earphones while having a nice quiet smoke outside, but sometimes the nice quiet smoke isn't, and I get distracted. To be honest, that episode last week was not one of my better efforts. I'll level with you guys. I am not happy with this Ghost Dance series I'm doing. I know exactly what I want to say, and these are things that urgently need to be said, to be heard and understood, especially as the Trump train gets closer and closer, flying off the rails and crashing and burning in a really spectacular wreck. But I've listened to those first two Ghost Dance clips, and there's just way too much waffling, way too much ritual disclaimer, way too much nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know what I mean? When the fact is that some of you probably don't know what I mean, especially young white people who have not read the Northwest novels and who are functionally, historically, and politically illiterate. Kids who know something is very badly wrong in the world, but who, beyond that, don't know their political and racial ass from a hole in the ground, and who need to have their hands held and be walked through every single little baby step. And yes, I admit to a certain amount of trepidation here. This has not been a good summer for me health-wise. I'm to turn 63 next month, and I really, really have better things to do with my remaining time than become involved in a major legal case. Although I understand that decision isn't up to me, and the secret police are going to just do whatever the hell they want, whenever they want, and there's nothing I can do about it. I understand that the knives have been out for the First Amendment for a long time, especially since we became a de facto dictatorship on November the 20th, 2014. And I understand that at some point, that dictatorship in the form of the absurdly misnamed Department of Justice is going to take a full-blown head-on run at freedom of speech in an attempt to legally redefine any criticism which suggests actual change as quote-unquote terrorism, or my favorite so far, quote-unquote making terroristic threats, which is one of those lovely charges that can mean any goddamn thing some U.S. attorney wants it to mean. Like the FBI agent who seriously sued Bill White in prison for emotional distress to the tune of $80,000, claiming that he was frightened by an email. An email which, if memory serves, wasn't even addressed to him. Real rough, tough secret police we got in this country, eh? Look, things need to be said, and my historic duty station within the movement for some decades now has always been to be the one who says them. I will become embroiled with the system on this if I have to. That's always been on the cards. But I want to sit back and study those first two Ghost Dance presentations because I know exactly where I'm going with this, but I'm not convinced I'm putting it across to you guys in any comprehensible form, so let me work on it for a while. Ideally, I should be sitting at a mahogany desk with a crackling fire in the hearth, or at this time of year, maybe a humming air conditioner in the window, wearing a dressing gown and drinking, if not a snifter of cognac, then at least a nice calming herbal tea or something of the kind. And I should be thinking long and hard in the blessed silence before carefully composing and editing my scripts for these audio presentations. And then when I'm ready, I should step down the hall to a fully equipped internet radio production room with state-of-the-art technology and a racist computer geek to act as sound engineer and handle all the tech so that I can actually concentrate on the big picture stuff like fearless leaders supposed to do. Now, you guys have decided that I don't get to do that. I hope one day you'll change your minds. But until then, the product that you get from me, if you want to call it that, will necessarily be raw and have quite a few rough edges. You know, we haven't heard from Lord Lucan for a while.
Let us talk about the real reason Arabs, that is Muslims, are driving taxis to and from the airport. It's the same reason the gypsies in England went door-to-door selling clothes pegs. Their men would be sleeping during the daytime. The women peddling clothes pegs would be casing which houses would be best to steal from. The gypsies would steal at night and would be gone the next day. The loot would be fenced. A taxi driver can figure out which houses would be vacant and therefore easier to steal from. Muslims practice the same immoral standards as the Jew does. They are permitted to lie, steal, and murder non-believers. The Talmud also teaches that a Jew is permitted to lie, steal, and murder non-Jews. Both Judaism and Islam are lawless religions. No Jew and no Muslim should ever become an American citizen. We are not a nation of immigrants, at least not since the late 19th century. The first American settlers came here from England on the Mayflower to escape from religious persecution. This led to the English Civil War, which was won by Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans, the same people that sailed on the Mayflower. However, after Cromwell died, they restored the monarchy. To this day, the Queen has to sign into law all the bills passed by Parliament. It is known as the Royal Assent. Therefore, there is one person and one person alone that can be blamed for the cesspit that England has become. Unlike France, there has never been a revolution in England. England is still a monarchy, with no First or Second Amendment. There can be no true democracy without the guarantee of freedom of speech, which doesn't exist in the United Kingdom. England is not a free country, because free men have the right to keep and bear arms, which does not exist in Britain. In England, as well as Canada, you can be arrested and sued for telling the truth about race and politics. And the truth is no legal defense in a court of law. Only America continued the work of Oliver Cromwell. Having a special relationship with England is a mistake. England signed the Balfour Document giving Palestine to Israel. The Jewish banking family of Rothschilds is a friend of the Queen. Rothschild lives in a palace near Birmingham, England. If England became dangerous to live in, I tell you that the Queen will be the first to leave. Now think back to the French Revolution. Who was the first to attempt to leave France? The King and Queen. The least patriotic people are your royals and the super rich. Nationalism is a poor man's political movement. The traitors to the white race are the rich. The traitors to the Constitution are the rich, as well as the Jews and Muslims. The communists, on the other hand, are traitors to the working class, the very class they claim to represent. The Clintons have become super rich as a result of their criminal conduct and their Clinton Foundation, which is a slush fund for all the bribes they have received. Bernie Sanders' support for Clinton at the Democratic Convention constitutes treason against the working class. Communist support for Jews or Muslims constitutes treason against the working class. Both religions constitute criminal gangs. Voting Democrat is, for all practical purposes, an act of treason in the next election. The rich in the Republican Party have already proved themselves to be traitors.
comrades. Tonight I'm going to be talking about Yabik. This is a reference book. Now, at first glance, it would really appear that this book is produced by the federal government. And indeed, one might even wonder whether someone should be reading this book. But when you look into it further, it evidently is published by a group that compiles this declassified information. Now, this is built around a naval postgraduate paper that was submitted in 2014. Jobbik, as we know, is an ultra-nationalist Hungarian party, and evidently it was founded in 2003. It's made some inroads into the Hungarian parliament, and this author who's writing this paper contends that Jobbik is unique. Now, the argument made for this uniqueness is that 22% of Jobbik members have university degrees. And it's also stated that Jobbik is somewhat leftist in that it wants to nationalize resources, unlike some other nationalist parties that seem to lean more towards capitalism. Considering the European movement, I find it highly questionable whether these features are really so unique, although they may seem so from an American lens. However, and even so, why would the Jobbik Party attract the attention of a naval post-grad, especially when finding literature on European parties can be like pulling teeth? And when you look a bit more closely at this report, I would say that the Trianon Treaty is really a large part of this. Now, in this brief report, I have not the inclination to go into the entire history of the Magyars and neighboring peoples, so I'd really like to start with the Revolution of 1848, where Hungary attempted to secede from the Habsburg and declared their own republic. However, the Habsburgs would not give up that easily, and in 1866, Habsburg Emperor Franz Joseph decided to appease the Hungarian revolt, and this led to the Austro-Hungarian Compromise of 1867. Now, soon afterwards, Croatia was recognized as independent. But even so, Austro-Hungary was the second largest country in Europe. And after World War I, Austro-Hungary was in chaos, much like Germany was. As in Germany, a leftist government came to power and decided to disarm, which left Hungary very vulnerable to various surrounding ethnic groups that were always trying to stake a claim. And in the midst of this chaos, Béla Kun proclaimed a Soviet-style republic. Now, that wasn't very long-lasting, and in 1920, the anti-communist white forces, and again using the term white as in the whites of the Russian Revolution being an anti-communist group, they once again regained control in a kind of military junta. Now, during the summer of that same year, the Entente redrew Hungary, and this was the idea of the sovereignty of small nations, where they wanted non-Hungarians to really be able to live in their own ethnic states. And this would really include many of the South Slavic groups and also the Romanians. Really, overall, Hungary lost 71% of its land mass and 64% of its population. And in reality, there were many Hungarians that found themselves outside of their ethnic homeland. Now, this was a very great trauma for Hungary. Thus, one major goal of the Jobbik Party is the restoration of pre-Trianon borders. This includes parts of Slovakia and Romania, which have sizable Magyar minorities. Thus, the Jobbik Party has a Eurosceptic position, and indeed, it would very much like to withdraw from that union. Now, the other thing about Jobbik is that it has a paramilitary with the goal of preparing youth spiritually and physically for regime change. This is not always unique in terms of these European parties. Indeed, The same is rumored, although I don't know that it's openly so, with regard to NDP affiliates. Even so, it is quite open. Hungary has a strong distaste for the U.S. and the West in general, although again, that might be said of any of your far-right European parties, although perhaps even more so in this case, because really these are Magyars in some sense, and in that way, somewhat more easterly in that regard. Instead of a love for the West and Americanization, Hungary has a love for tradition. And indeed, at least at the time of this writing, this has led to an embrace of the Muslim world, and in particular, the Shia aspect of that world, which would specifically be Iran and also Syria under Assad. Putin also has his desires, and he would like to extend something called the Eurasian Union, which now exists as an economic group, to all post-Soviet states. And when we talk post-Soviet states, we're talking specifically of the former Soviet Union. Now, clearly, it is hoped by some that, I suppose some in Putin's circles, and I suppose some in Yavik as well, that this could be extended to former East Bloc countries, that Hungary could leave the EU and join this Eurasian Union. The U.S. military does not believe that Hungary will ever go back to the pre-Trianon borders because they believe that is unrecoverable. But they do believe the Jobbik letter-influenced government can still be useful to NATO. The U.S. does not want to have too strong a reaction to this desire for sovereignty because that would only play into the hands of Jobbik party members who cry out for the sovereignty and who talk about Hungary as constantly besieged by invaders from the Ottomans to the Habsburgs, to other groups, to perhaps the Slovaks, etc. Now, this author talks a bit about fascism and says that it's always been a movement of emotion and charisma. The writer of this postgraduate paper discusses the history of the Austria Freedom Party in the early 90s and talks about how the UE tends to do little to influence trends that it dislikes. So, in a way, this report is interesting, but it seems to trail off, coming to only this conclusion that the status quo can be maintained despite groups such as Jobbik. Now, the rest of this book is a report on various national security issues. It does reiterate the strong ambitions of Putin, and it's concerned about these as it sees them as upsetting the status quo. Now, the rest of this report deals with the United States as a kind of super Israel in the Puritan sense, maintaining this Pax Romana, this worldwide order. The report talks about the economy and the 2008 recession that it says is now abating and the recovery is taking place. It talks about the mistake that was made in terms of Libya, also Syria, and the fact that Russia is trying to hold up the Assad regime, as is Iran and Hezbollah and Russia, so lining up on the Shia side, whereas the U.S. has failed to aid moderate rebels in Syria who were against the regime, and this led to the extreme refugee crisis and ISIS. Now, all this lack of action, and ISIS, by the way, is a Sunni group, really does lend credence to the rumors of secret Islam or sympathy of some kind on the behalf of the current president. Now, there's different ideas as to whether he's more of a Sunni sympathizer or more of a Shia sympathizer. Some stories that he is secretly sympathizing with ISIS. and thus his inaction. Now, of course, the media dismisses this idea as barking mad, and indeed, in a mainstream sense, it may sound that way, but there has been a great deal of inaction on the part of the current administration, so one has to ask why. Now, this report also notes that there are many people in this world who are under 30. Now, given the low white birth rate, I would fear that many such persons are not white, and indeed it is stated that many of these individuals are living in Africa or Southeast Asia. Now, the current administration, or maybe even the government in general, they really want to have exchange with these people. Maybe even bring such persons in for job diversity due to language skills. Now, this is, in a macabre way, this is all, in a sense, very humorous if you have a dark sense of humor. And it also talks about the NSA and how this information is gathered largely on foreigners. But it also mentions that there are such a thing as non-state actors, but they're mentioned only briefly. Now, it is noted that when U.S. persons, when their information is collected, this is only cross-referenced through analytic deductions, it says. Unevaluated information is kept only for 5 years, if justified. So I found this report very interesting, particularly to learn about Hungary and the various geopolitics of the situation. I'm always fascinated with geopolitics. I think that's really where it's at in terms of understanding the way the world works in broad strokes. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Got a little 1980s movie nostalgia for you here. This is the Battle of the Mounds from Conan the Barbarian. Okay, I want to talk to you guys about something serious now. It's Donald Trump related, very much so, so I won't make it a ghost dance piece, but it's important. Now, most of you will either have read one or more of my Northwest Independence novels, or you'll be familiar with their basic premise of an IRA-style guerrilla insurgency which leads to an independent white homeland in the Pacific Northwest. Now, that's certainly one way in which, quote-unquote, it could happen, but I have never maintained that this is the only way it could happen. There are a number of possible scenarios, and thanks to Donald Trump, such a scenario is now realistically within the realm of possibility in a way that a year ago no one could have anticipated. I've been saying for years that the Northwest Imperative is the only plan for white racial survival, and it still is as far as actual plans go. But I have never denied that it may turn out to be a case simply of world geopolitical and biopolitical conditions catching up with us all, without any kind of planning or time for preparation on anyone's part. Now, thanks to DJT, this may happen in as little as 78 days. Okay, let's look at a wildest case scenario. I'd tell you this is sheer speculation, but actually it's not. History is replete with similar crisis events from the time of Julius Caesar on down. Now, I say again, America is not exceptional, and we possess no magical immunity from history or the forces of human nature and the human character, which, despite a couple of generations of left-liberal social engineering, is still pretty much the same kind of human nature that people in Julius Caesar's time possessed. If Donald Trump were elected president, I wouldn't be too surprised to see him knifed to death on the Senate floor by a bunch of congressmen with daggers under their togas, or some modern-day equivalent. Okay, let's set the scene. It is now November of 2016, 80 days from now, more or less. Hillary Clinton has officially, quote-unquote, won the presidential election, or at least that's what the media tells us, and that's what the dictatorship tells us. All hail she who must be obeyed. But during the preceding 70-odd days, certain things have happened, and on Election Day, November the 8th, certain things damn sure happened that even this controlled media cannot suppress thanks to the Internet. I have no idea what these things might be, but they would almost certainly have to do with very serious electoral fraud that stole the presidential election from Donald Trump. Now, in this projected November of 2016, it will, through whatever means, be clear to the general public that the election was invalid because the results were rigged beforehand, as we now know that Hillary Clinton did to her primary opponent, Bernie Sanders, thanks to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and also thanks to a young man named Seth Rich, who appears to have paid with his life for crossing the Hildebeest in order to bring this knowledge to the world's attention. And maybe a few other bodies will have dropped by then as well. In essence, the white people of this nation will see themselves being flipped the bird and told to fuck off by the United States government or the Democratic Party that controls that government. We are going to be told, possibly even in so many words, and I quote, "You don't get to decide who sits in that chair at 1600 Pennsylvania. We decide that, not you. George Soros and Goldman Sachs and Rachel Maddow and Wolf Blitzer and Black Lives Matter, that's our decision and you get no say, white boy. Okay, you've had your fun with this Trump business, but it's time for you to be quiet and crawl back into your doghouse now. You and your boy Donald lost. You know why? Because we say you lost. And what are you going to do about it? Nothing. Because you're too weak and timid and scared. You're not gonna revolt, because you don't have the balls, and we all know it. So go slinking home like the cowardly little pups you are, and go back to hiding behind your computers and your silly Twitter IDs and your video games. The world is ours, and we decide who gets what, and we decide you get nothing, yeah." Or a general media message to that effect. Basically, around Thanksgiving, it will sink in to the white people of this country that we, in fact, elected Donald Trump as president of the United States, but that our votes were stolen or simply ignored, and the results were falsified, at least in the small number of key states and precincts necessary to swing the Electoral College to the Seahag. It can now be done not through the type of elaborate ballot box stuffing that Democrats spent 150 years perfecting from the days of Tammany Hall until the present day, but just through a few simple clicks on a computer mouse. And make no mistake, it will be done. Hillary Clinton and the Democrats are going to rig and steal this election. Guys, I hate to be constantly raining on the parade, but I just can't see Donald Trump being allowed anywhere near the Oval Office in real life. So, it's November the 9th, and leaving aside the possibility of assassination, which they may yet opt for, Donald Trump has clearly been robbed of his due, and the whole world knows it. First question, what will Trump himself do? Most likely, he will scream and bawl and holler and go running to the courts, but that's no good. By this point, the courts are stacked with judges who were either appointed by the Democrats, the Clintons, or the Bush family. You know, as in Jeb Bush, who was supposed to get the nomination that Trump ran off with. Now, what kind of results do you think Trump will get either from a Clinton or a Bush-appointed judge? Not to mention the fact that the Supreme Court itself currently has only 8 justices, so the 2000 option that put juggiers in office won't serve. Anyway, the court battle option won't work, and the long waiting will probably just diffuse the whole thing, and by the time Trump is told to piss off by the courts, the short American attention span will have kicked in and his followers will have wandered away now that there's no more bells and whistles. Now, I know that feeling, believe me. I also think Trump is savvy enough to find some way to keep the bells and whistles going and keep that short attention span fixed on something. So, if Trump is cheated out of the presidency, most likely we're looking at a whole new form of racial entertainment based around the mythos of the stolen 2016 election. And that's all to the good. Plus, there will be the general mainstreaming effect for our various points of view and spokesmen that the left loons have already started complaining about on their blogs and whatnot. Again, all to the good. A lot of interesting possibilities will open as the system continues to decay under President Hildebeest. But suppose, just suppose now, that to everyone's utter astonishment, it turns out that Donald Trump actually has some balls. Suppose he decides that either for the sake of the country or more likely because of his own boundless ego, he's just not going to allow the beast to steal the office that the people of this country voted him. Historically and situationally speaking, there would be several, I suppose you'd call them out-of-the-box options open to President Trump if there were any attempt to keep him out of the office to which he was, in fact, elected by the votes of the people. Unfortunately, they all require Julius Caesar-like courage in that at some point Trump would be required to stand on the banks of the River Rubicon and give the order to cross. I know the majority of you have no idea at all what I'm talking about there. All I can say is Google the term crossing the Rubicon, R-U-B-I-C-O-N. Now, in order to prevent the presidency from being stolen from him, Trump would be required to step outside the framework of the tyrant's laws, as will we all one day. We won't be able to help it. When the tyrant's law decrees that no one can breathe, people really don't have the choice. They have to breathe, and thereby they break the law and become criminals. To use a more familiar analogy, when the game has been rigged and you know that there's no way you can win, your only remaining play is to kick over the table. We in this country pride ourselves on our ability to find ways to avoid any responsibility or accountability for pretty much anything we do. Given enough money and the right connections, an American can pretty much whirl away from almost any foul deed, like Tinkerbell. Look at Michael Jackson and Hillary Clinton. There's nothing an American loves better than a chance to play without pay. But in this case, for stakes this high, at some point Donald Trump will either have to fold or else he'll have to put something on the table. Americans hate doing that. They want to play, they want the spills and chills and thrills, but they never want to put anything on the table, which is why we never win anything worth having. This essentially is what I'm always begging you guys to do with my fund appeals and my constant pleas for you to come to the Northwest and form racial communities of people living within half an hour's drive of one another. Now, you claim to want a specific result from me, a result that even at this late stage I might be able to give you, but you don't want to put anything on the table. Now, I have to be honest, guys. I swear, I don't think Trump has the stones to say no and mean it. I don't think he has the strength of character and the will to lead a revolt and force the Democrats to comply with the will of the people. But what if he does? What could he do? The first thing he needs to do, somehow, is to stall until spring and the warm weather comes. Whatever Trump is planning will almost certainly involve large crowds of people, either in political rallies like he's doing now or else as a citizens' militia. And American white boys do not like to go out into the cold and the wet and the rain and the snow and the freezing temperatures. This is why that buffoon Ammon Bundy could only get about 30 or 40 people to follow him up to Oregon last January. January on the high plains in the West. Jesus Christ on a raft. What was going on in that man's mind? Anyway, Trump has proven that he can get white boys to respond en masse, something no one else in this country has ever been able to do since the time of George Wallace, but I'm not sure how many people he could get to come out to a rally in mid-January. Hell, maybe he could, but still, I'd recommend that he at least take the weather into consideration, alongside the weak character, lack of physical fitness and hardihood of American white boys, not to mention the fact that the left loons do have something of a point, and that a lot of Trump's people are getting a bit long in the tooth, like me. Us old guys may be willing in spirit, but the flesh is weak. Okay, there are still a couple of reserves remaining of young, physically fit, and combat-skilled white males, these being A, large segment of the police around the country, and B, certain elite United States military units, including most of the Marine Corps. It is entirely possible that events subsequent to a fraudulent election will require that those units be deployed by one side or the other. Now, beyond that, I don't want to start shouting the odds here quite yet, because we simply do not know what the situation is going to be in real life. I repeat that I simply can't see Donald Trump raising his standard like Money Prince Charlie by Locke Scheel. Although, God, don't you know a showman like Trump could make a cinematic and political masterpiece for the ages out of something like that? But he won't. I'm sorry, guys, I just don't think he has the balls. But what if I'm wrong? What if he does? And we will then be back in the spring of 1861, and every police officer and every serving member of the United States military is going to have to make the same decision men did in that time, whether or not to obey orders from people whom you know in your hearts are no longer qualified or entitled to give them. Orders that you do things you know are not only illegal, but profoundly immoral. You cops and soldiers will have to decide where your loyalties lie. To truth and honor and the law and the Constitution? To the communities where you live and where your children have to live and grow? Or to the yellow-skinned mulatto people, the people with the big noses, the sickening sexual deviants, and the pale men without souls who ignore all of those, but who drop that direct deposit into your bank accounts every month? If you are a police officer, a corrections officer, a soldier, or a sailor, and Donald Trump issues the call, you will have to decide the price of your soul. That price used to be 30 pieces of silver, and Hillary Clinton can pay it with all that cash in her foundation. What's the going rate for a soul these days? If through some inconceivable reversion to a much older genotype, Donald J. Trump does decide to cross the Rubicon, rather than allow himself to be scorned and humiliated before a madwoman, then we need to lay all of our doubts and reservations aside and do all in our power to help President Trump to triumph. And boy, ain't that kind of politics going to make us some really strange bedfellows. Yeah, I'm fully aware of what I've said about Trump in the past, and I stand by it. I may be proven right about him in the future, but the Germans have a word. Realpolitik. This is realpolitik. The object will not be to secure Trump's victory, but to ensure the defeat of his enemies, if you get the difference. See what I mean here? Remember what Trump's true purpose in the scheme of things is. He is the force, the power that will clear away the debris that started accumulating 104 years ago. He can do that with his billions and his media presence. Absent our willingness to do the necessary ourselves, we can't. We haven't even been on the playing field before this, but thanks to Trump, we are now at least on the peripheral edges. We have a seat on the farthest end of the bench. 78 days left, people, and depending on the courage and character of one man, it may be showtime for real. It's been that way often in the past for our people. Let's see how it plays out.
This one night receive thy soul.
Okay, this is part one of an interview that I did with a British podcaster named Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. It was broadcast on August the 18th on the Barnes Review show. I'd like to apologize for the sound quality here. It's not what it might be.
Hello, everybody. Before I bring up today's guest, the legendary Harold Covington, I want to start with Harold's response to any accusation that he is guilty of inciting others to criminal activity and violence. This is as stated in part one of his new Ghost Dance series that we will cover later in the show, which is available on northwestfront.org under the Radio Free NW on the navigation bar. Harold says, "I am inciting to change. Things have reached the point where fundamental, systemic change in the way Western civilization is ordered and run, and a complete revision of who orders and runs it, is now essential to the survival of the race that created that civilization. If someone can think of some way in which that complete systemic change from top to bottom, in both operation and composition, can be brought about without taking direct action of any kind, then I would in fact far prefer it. But that's not the issue any longer. The brutal and overwhelming historic fact is that we who must try to exist in what remains of American society have now reached the point in our journey to oblivion where the end really does justify the means. America now offers people with our racial and cultural heritage nothing but unending misery, servitude, and early death in squalor. I say to you now that the world must change." On that basis, I'm delighted to welcome Harold to the show. Harold, are you with me?
Right here.
Excellent. Right, well, as this is a what I call a bio show, just to sort of introduce you to the listeners and what have you. Firstly, I'd like you to give the listeners an introduction to Harold Covington. Please could you run through a biography of how you started off in life to where you are today in as little or as great a detail as you would like?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in North Carolina. I'm 62 years old, be 63 next month, and I served in both the United States Army and the Rhodesian Army. I first became involved in racial politics. Well, it depends on how you look at it. You could say that it was 48 years ago when I became involved with the George Wallace for President campaign at the tender age of 14, or you could say it was 44 years ago when I first joined the old American Nazi Party of Commander George F. Rockwell, which was then called the National Socialist White People's Party, out of Franklin Road in Arlington, Virginia. And I have a long and varied history of various groups and organizations that I've worked with down through the years, but probably about average for someone of my movement generation. And it would be very long and tedious for me to get into that because most people probably have no idea who these people and groups were. Our movement has a tendency to produce kind of groups that come and go in Britain as here. And I am also the author of 21 books right now. The ones that I'm most known for are the five Northwest Independence novels, wherein I describe the establishment of a sovereign and independent white nation here in the Pacific Northwest of North America by an IRA-style insurgency carried out over a period of 5 years by a group I call the NVA, the Northwest Volunteer Army. I was kind of inspired to some degree in that endeavor through having lived in Ireland on and off for about 5 years as an observer, although not a participant in the troubles there. I got a sort of a first-hand view of how it's done, you might say, as opposed to the sort of thing we've been wasting our time with over here in this country. And at the moment, I'm the chief spokesperson for the Northwest Front, which is a group or movement advocating the establishment of such a white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest.
Excellent. With regard to your books, you mentioned you've written 21 books and you've got the 5 Northwest novels. You've also written some factual books as well, you know, historical books. Is there any that you could give people what you would recommend as like an introduction to your work? And also with the novels, what you would recommend people would start off with the novels and where they can get these books?
I started writing when I was 11 years old, and the first published book I had was a historical novel set at the time of the Wars of the Roses in England. I wrote that when I was 16 years old. It is available now on Amazon and from other places. It's called Rose of Honor, but obviously it's been updated quite a bit since then. I've written a lot of fiction, historicals, mysteries, thriller-type stuff, political thrillers. I've written a couple of anti-Clinton novels back in the 90s, and, of course, Northwest novels themselves. My factual books, I guess you would call them, would consist of one that I wrote in 1987 called The March Up Country, which was about the movement in general, movement activism as it existed in 1987. So it's very dated by today's standards. For one thing, it was completely pre-internet. And I've also got a book called Dreaming the Iron Dream, which is a collection of my essays. And finally, I've got something that's not entirely written by me. Some of them were a series of 56 long and short articles called the Weird Aryan History Series. That actually hasn't been published as such in book form, but I will be happy to send anyone who's interested in Weird Aryan History a PDF of that. I've got a couple of shorter follow-up pieces, which is Weird Jewish History and Weird Gay History. So my books are still available online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Olibris.com, and so forth. There was a bit of a problem last summer, about a year ago, when a kid named Dylan Roof went berserk in Charleston with a gun, and that led to my getting some attention because Roof mentioned the Northwest Front in his manifesto. The result was that the actual publishers of many of my books, not all of them, but many of them, canceled their publishing contracts. And at first I was very sort of downcast by that because I figured, you know, my books would just simply disappear offline. But they're still there. And this has to do with I won't call it a glitch, but with the way that the print-to-order publishing industry operates. Basically, it's not just the original publisher that has the templates and the setup for these works, and a number of smaller outfits can still fill orders for my books, so they are still available, and so far as I'm aware, will continue to be available, and if nothing else, I can always simply distribute them in PDF or hand-printed format. That's one good thing about the age of the Internet. It is now virtually impossible for the Jews to completely silence or suppress a book like they used to back in the old purely printed page days. So they are still available. If anyone wishes to contact me at NWNet, that's NWNET, at earthlink.net, I'll be happy to send you pretty much any of my works you care to read in PDF format if you don't mind reading them on a computer screen. I get a lot of stick from a lot of my friends and comrades telling me that I need to be selling these books instead of giving them away, but in the case of the Northwest novels and the political material, I didn't write these things in order to make money. The Northwest novels, frankly, are the largest, or I should say the primary propaganda weapon that the Northwest independence movement has, and we need to get them distributed as widely as possible and read as widely as possible. So basically, I'll be happy to send anyone a free copy in PDF format by email attachment who wishes to read any of my work. And if someone likes a printed book to hold in the hand, they're old-fashioned that way like I am, they can order printed paperback and in some cases hardback copies online. And I'll be happy to guide them to where they can find those.
Thank you, Harold. And is the correct address nwnet@earthlink.net?
That's correct. nwnet@earthlink.net.
Excellent. Right, now, moving on, as you know, I live in London, and I understand that you've also lived in London, so I would
lived in Earl's Court in the early 80s, and then when I was living with my New Zealand lady, I lived for about a year in Leighton in the East End.
Okay, yeah, I know both of those. As you know, I'm in South London. the other side of the river. But what was your, can you run through any memorable experiences in the UK? I mean, what years were you living there and anything interesting that happened that you recall?
Well, I was about 6 months in London in 1983. That was when I was living in Earl's Court. I have always had a great affinity with Great Britain, and I've always wanted to live there. And so even as sleazy and impoverished as my lifestyle was at the time, I was actually quite fascinated by it all. The racial situation was bad even then. The number of non-whites in the city was very noticeable. In Earl's Court, we had, you know, Arabs walking around in full native dress and burnouses and that sort of stuff, Saudis and whatnot. But still, it was quite an interesting place and an interesting time to be there. I do recall one experience, and this was in 83 now, the summer of 83. I was on Oxford Street in London, and I was feeling my peckish, and I went into a Wimpy bar, and I was the only person in there who spoke English, and that included the staff.
Wow.
They were all logs of some kind, packies or whatever, and that was in 1983, and I'm told now that London is a majority non-white city, and I'm really sorry to see that happen, because a lot of the great monuments and a lot of the great history of our race is concentrated in the London area, and it really pains me to think of things like Westminster Abbey and the Tower of London and all these various sights and sounds of London being overrun and being turned into a Muslim bazaar. So in Leighton, it was very much more, East End-ish. Well, it is in the East End. I mean, I understand that basically the last of the white Cockney native people have been virtually driven out of the East End now, but in those days, although there were a lot of Jamaicans and whatnot in the area, it was still actually majority white in that area. My girlfriend and I would go up to, the market in Walthamstow and places like that, and we'd go out to Epping Forest on a Sunday, and so it was still livable. It was expensive as hell. We were paying £100 a week for flat that was roughly the size of two coffins nailed together, and that was in the early 90s. So, again, even when I was there both times in London, it was crowded. It was offensively multiracial. The crime was unpleasant. Of course, when I was there in the early 90s, it was also during the IRA bombing campaign when they basically were shutting down the transportation system every week and had bombs going off all over the city. I was a bank guard at the time in Bishopsgate, and I actually, through more accident than anything else, got pulled into being one of the first responders to the Baltic Exchange bomb in April of 92. So I did like London nevertheless, even though there were all kinds of problems when I lived there. But I see street scenes in London right now on the internet, and it looks to me like it's just become essentially a non-white city. I wouldn't want to go there. I wouldn't want to live there now.
No, I absolutely agree with you. It was recently revealed that it's 60% non-white, and as I say to people, in 10 years, what do you think that's going to be? Do you think it's going to drop to 50, or do you think it's going to go beyond 70? You know, it's absolutely clear what is going on, and we are definitely being bred out, as it were.
Maybe you can answer a question for me. I have my own show, call-in show, and we have some British people calling in. I always ask them, where the hell are all the white people going over there? I mean, they're being pushed out of the city. I've seen several articles about how the last of the white native Cockneys are being pushed out of the East End. Where are they going?
Well, they seem to, I mean, it started off, they called it white flight. Well, it's the same in America, isn't it? You've got this white flight. They tend to go over to areas like Essex, and then, for example, you're probably familiar with Chelsea Football Club. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of Chelsea fans in Sutton, which is South London, and Sutton was really regarded as more Surrey. Mm-hmm. But they're Chelsea fans because they were part of families, they're sort of descendants of families that fled in the 50s and 60s, etc., and they moved out to Sutton to get to a white area. And the funny thing is that, as you know, Harold, the multiculturalism just spreads. And so, essentially, now you've got one of the biggest mosques in the country being built in Epsom, which is Surrey, where you've got the Derby Day horse race, etc. And I grew up in Epsom Downs, a couple of minutes walk from the racecourse. And to actually find out you've got one of the largest mosques in the country built there is quite astonishing. And it just goes to prove that these non-whites, they breed a far higher rate than the white native population.
Yeah, well, in addition to which, we found in this country that white flight is, in the long run, rather pointless because basically the blacks and the browns simply follow. They are essentially parasitic, and they cannot live without white hosts. basically while the whites flee the city and leave the blacks alone to run things on their own, what you get is Detroit, what you get is Baltimore, what you get is Newark, New Jersey, what you get is Atlanta and Birmingham. And you guys over there in Britain probably wouldn't be familiar with those cities, but they're just wastelands now. Housing is very expensive here in the part of the Northwest where I live, but if it was just a matter of wanting to buy a house, I could go to Detroit and I could literally buy a house for a dollar just for unpaid taxes in most of Detroit. Of course, the thing is, you don't want to live in Detroit. There's no services, there's no police, the running water doesn't work, they've got brownouts on a regular basis, the streets are full of trash, the streets are crumbling and falling to pieces. Plus, you've got all sorts of violent mongoids roaming up and down, attacking people and killing people and eating each other. The mud flow follows white people because they can't live without us. I suppose, if I ever engaged in debate with any of these Black Lives Matter people, which I have no intention of doing, but I would ask them, look, if us whites are so privileged and so racist and we make your spaces unsafe and we just upset you so much and that sort of stuff, why do you want to live around us? Why can't you just go off in one corner and be with yourselves and we can go off in our little corner and be with it? But no, that can't be. There must be diversity. There must be forced multiculturalism and mixing. And one of the reasons for that is the fact is that these non-white races simply cannot exist in any kind of semi-civilized state without the white man to keep order and to provide the infrastructure and basically to pay for it all.
Yes, and how about the push for the racial mixing, you know, the big push for the white women to breed with the black man?
I don't know how it is in Britain. Over here, it's mostly white women going with Negroid men. I don't know what words I'm allowed to use on here. If this is the Barnes Review, I imagine they want to keep it fairly sedate and not use certain politically forbidden words, but mostly it's black males and white females. The big press for white men for mixture is either Hispanic or Asian females. I mean, basically, no one wants to get involved with the Negroes. I mean, how can you? My God, they look like gorillas. I've never understood how anybody can do it, but especially how a white man could get involved with a Negroes, because, I mean, it's a form of bestiality. Never mind the sexual part of it, just how can you sleep in the same bed with one? My God, the smell alone would...
I think that certainly it's similar in the UK, that it's all the white women who go for the black men. And I mean, the risk of boring my audience, I have stated several times that in the area that I'm in, undertook a survey of my own for a 2-3 week period in which I would look into a stroller casually that was being pushed by a white woman, and 8 out of 10 of these babies in there were black. And so it's become that much of a, it's become a first choice for these people. And it really is astonishing. But it's all so obvious. It's so obvious that they're trying to breed the white race out. Because not only do we have the mass immigration, but we have the promotion in all... I think the worst one is advertising now. That's what's really picked up on it. You've got adverts for banks with a black man and a white woman about a mortgage. You know, they're not responding to it. They're encouraging it. You see, and they're showing that is the way the family is now. And if you're a white person with a white man with a white woman, then you're behind the times. What you do find as well, I mean, I saw this, funny enough, only yesterday, Harold, and I saw a white man walking down the road. He was sort of thin and gangly, you know, he didn't really look much, a nerd, if you will. And with him was a short Asian woman. And of course, these ones end up with the Asian women because they can't get a white woman or impress a white woman. But of course, most white men are now affected by that. And so a lot of white men, you very rarely get them with black women, but you are getting them increasingly with Asian women. You've had them with the Chinese, the Filipino, and that for many years. And that's really what I'm seeing around here.
The only solution to this, basically, is the creation of what's known as the ethnostate. Certain stretches of territory have to be reserved for the different races, and these territories must be kept absolutely separate in that there is to be no trespassing, no... Well, on the website at northwestfront.org, your listeners will find a draft of our Northwest Republic's Constitution. And in the first article, basically, it states that the Northwest American Republic is to be for white people only traditional descendants of the white European family of nations. Jews are specifically excluded. Jews are not white. They are Asiatics, and it says so in the Constitution. And there are to be no non-whites of any kind physically resident, because if they are there, even in a subordinate position, be it slavery or whatever, eventually the barriers will break down and there will be racial admixture. And that has to stop, because that is genocide. It's like the old saying, racial integration or diversity is about like mixing horse manure and ice cream. It does wonders for the manure, but it doesn't do much for the ice cream. Racial admixture always degrades the white racial strain, even as it ever so slightly improves the Negroid or dark strain. I mean, yeah, you get Barack Obama, but, you know, who wants to be Barack Obama?
Yes.
Well, for now, time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaman. Freedom.